politics for? And in that context, is Putin's marathon phone-in direct line actually a good thing? And after the break, as a coalition forces withdraw from Afghanistan, a brief comparison of that particular forever war and the Soviet Union's own. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. Do allow me to start with a little philosophical interlude with this question of precisely what are politics for? Look, ultimately, politics is the mechanism for, and this may sound terribly cynical, the efficient and adequately proportionate distribution of coercion and resources, and clearly the one often creates the other. Now, democracies work because, well, they generally work. They reduce, without admittedly eliminating, the kind of political cartels that seek to monopolize resources. And above all, they are especially responsive. You know, as a disgruntled constituency emerges, generally people will emerge with them who will mobilize these constituencies for political purpose, whether it's in terms of setting up a pressure group or a new political party or just lots of aggrieved letters to the press. Doesn't really matter. Once that happens, these people will begin to become important and therefore potentially dangerous to the system, to the status quo as a whole. And so measures will be taken to bring them into the system, to put it bluntly, to buy them off. And that's a good thing, because it keeps enough people happy enough for the system to roll on. People may well feel that democracy is naturally wonderful, that there is something intrinsically special in being able to vote, to be able to be represented. But I'll be honest, I always do wonder how many of those people know who their MP is, let alone would be able to outline his or her particular interests or their voting record, for example. I'm not doing democracy down here, absolutely no, not at all. But what I'm suggesting is that its key virtue is what it does, in terms of providing some guarantees against arbitrary rule, crony kleptocracy, and the exclusion of whole communities, rather than actually what it is. Now, the reason why I embarked on this particular self-indulgent rumination is indeed Wednesday's Direct Line, the annual, though they didn't hold it last year, big phone-in in which Putin gets to meet his people, albeit in a very, very curated sample of his people and over the phone or through a screen. So this was, in this case, it was a 3-hour, 42-minute, middle-length epic by his standards in which he addressed 68 questions. And look, there are other places where the actual general role of the direct line has been discussed. I mean, broadly speaking, it's an opportunity, first of all, for him to project himself in three particular roles. The first is father of the nation, the man who cares about what his individual subjects think and wants to give them a chance to tell them their woes. Secondly, the detail-oriented chief executive. Needless to say, look, all these questions are very, very carefully curated, and either he is already briefed with all the detail, or he has a voice in his ear feeding him the necessary facts. But one way or the other, the point is, he then gets to talk about, I don't know, how much new road was built in Omsk last year, or, you know, what is the current budget apportionment to Yakutia. Doesn't matter. But the point is exactly, he has to demonstrate that although he has this huge responsibility of being the decider for everything that happens within the Russian Federation, he is up to it. And thirdly, and more primordially, it is a chance to demonstrate that the kindly Tsar,
who cares about his people, is watching over the boyars, who are, of course, the source of all mistakes and blunders, nothing to do with central policy. So this is why he will keep saying, oh, we'll definitely look into this, or no, that's been a mistake that's been done at the local level, and obviously why, as soon as he highlights some particular case of, you know, a school here that hasn't been redeveloped as it should or whatever, then the local mayors and governors will be scurrying to demonstrate, probably within the day, that something is being done as a result, and already the bulldozers or the plasterers or whatever are out. And in this respect, actually, this is a very modern equivalent of the old tradition of being able to petition the Tsar. That, you know, he would put aside a certain amount of time regularly, that no matter how lowly you were as a subject of the Tsar, you had a chance to petition him and bring your grievances to his adjudication and attention. And yes, that's why they had more than 2 million questions which were sent in. And I mean, I don't know the size of the audience this year. I haven't seen figures yet. But if we look at 2019, it was around 20 million, as I understand. Not because this was great television. I mean, trust me, it is a very, very boring exercise in watching, you know, a grey man in a grey suit address various questions in a not especially charismatic manner. But that's not the point. I mean, people watch it in part because this is the opportunity to get a sense of what the kind of big policy lines are that the chief executive is pushing out. But it's also just to see, it's the kind of, I don't know, the national lottery school of politics. You know, will it be you? Will it happen to be your question or someone from your township that gets the opportunity to put their issue to the Tsar and no doubt have the issue fixed? So, you know, that, I think, is a large degree of the sort of vicariousness of what they're looking at. And as a result, I said I wanted to dwell on one particular aspect, though, of this whole exercise that I think is often neglected beyond the sort of theatricality of politics. And that is to go back to the questions. Look, this is an authoritarian regime which is obsessed with knowing what its people, subjects, victims, call them what you will, what they think. We have all kinds of open polling that takes place and is clearly discussed at a high level. We have the particular polling that is carried out by the Federal Protection Service, the FSO, that I've talked about in a previous podcast. And which kind of provides, and clear, needless to say, I mean, this is done through front organisations. People don't just turn up in uniform with a gun on their hip and saying, tell me what you think about the regime. You know, but nonetheless, there is an additional sort of very, very extensive strand of public attention, public opinion monitoring that's carried out by the FSO. It's one of the reasons for organisations like the All Russian Popular Front, the ONF, which is there, you know, in part as a political support base for United Russia, but it's also in part as a way of bringing in all kinds of elements of civil society and not just making them feel included and thus trying to sort of win their support and woo them, but also to get a sense of what they're actually thinking and saying. It's evident in a massive range of consultative bodies that exist, which again, on one level, may seem entirely trivial at best, actively problematic at worst, because they simply allow the state to co-opt good ideas and to give the appearance that it cares about what its subjects feel. But the point is, there is more to that. They do absolutely listen to what issues come up. And finally, there's a whole array of KPIs, key performance indicators, whereby, you know, local governors and mayors and other officials are assessed. And that depends on a huge amount of number crunching, which again relates to not just performance, but also what are the issues, what is the level of support, the level of happiness of the population. Now, why does the Kremlin bother doing this, given that it's also going to rig elections and poison opposition figures and such like? Well, look, the enlightened autocrat wants you to be happy. If you're happy, you'll continue to let him and his cronies get away with whatever they want. So again, this is the point. It's not actually as if this is a regime that wants to rule through oppression and fear. It would much rather rule through making people happy, so long as that can be reconciled with the priorities of the ruling elite. And I mean, this is the reason why many Russians are not happy. It's not that the Kremlin doesn't know what they want, but because it doesn't want to give them it, you know, money that otherwise would go to the military or the space program or embezzlement, reforms that would constrain the elite. There are some public desiderata that, frankly, the Kremlin doesn't want to give them. Because, after all, that's the reasons why they're in power. This is why they schemed and politicked to the top of the system. Or else it's because the Kremlin is not efficient enough to be able to provide it. Or that it has tried unsuccessfully to convince the people that they didn't really want it after all. I mean, it's quite interesting if one looks at the constant struggle, whereby the Kremlin tries to present Russia as being this embattled, beleaguered fortress, and that as a result, various overseas adventures should be seen in the context of, in some ways, kind of forward defence. They are about protecting Russia's interests beyond. But the point is, things like Donbass or Syria, let alone other things like Venezuela and Libya, are still absolutely not popular with the Russian public, which is basically why they are fed a very, very constrained, censored and spun version of the reality. The fact of the matter is the Kremlin is not always very good at convincing people that they are more interested in fancy new nuclear missiles rather than decent roads. So this is the overall sort of context. And in this respect, I think the Direct Line's great virtue is precisely that huge body of 2+ million questions which have come in, many of which are actually really critical. Now, sure, we don't tend to get to see those. The questions are actually sort of either cherry-picked or maybe even written precisely to give the impression that, you know, that the regime wants, though there was an entertaining blunder where at one point when they were looking at the centre, which collated all the questions on TV, the camera dwelt a little bit too long on a screen and we saw some very critical questions which had come in. Needless to say, there was not the kind of questions that made it to Direct Line. But the point is this, the audience may, in the main, not actually get to see all those critical demands and requests, but the Kremlin does. If we're talking about public opinion, it's not just simply a question of are they positive or negative toward the government. It's also about the intensity of that feeling. I mean, in some ways, you can think of it as a 2x2 grid with an X and a Y axis. So there's, are you positive or negative toward the government? And how passionate do you feel about that? Are you essentially passive or active? If you are both passionate and active in support of the regime, well, then you are one of the ardent Putinists. And they absolutely do exist. They're not all just doing that because of careerism or whatever. You know, there are people who are strongly supportive of the regime. If you are supportive of the regime but passive, well, you're the sort of person who doesn't really think about politics much, probably, but you will go out and vote for United Russia in the September Duma elections and for Putin in the presidential elections. That's fine. If you are negative to the regime but passive, you've probably pretty much opted out of politics. I mean, what is the point? Why bother getting involved? Just, you know, enjoy your life, watch some telly, whatever it is. However, if you are hostile to the regime and active, that's when you become problematic. If one looks at Direct Line, if people are willing enough to break cover and actually send the Kremlin itself a critical note, a critical question, in other words, a sign of how they feel, look, it's not that actually they, you know, face arrest or anything like that, you know, but nonetheless, they know that they are bringing themselves to the attention of a regime which, you know, they regard as hostile and oppressive, and which, let's be honest, is also increasingly oppressive at the moment. So it's not that the Kremlin is going to necessarily act against them, but nonetheless, it will be aware of the balance, how many people do this. I mean, look, this is not like a carefully constructed sample. I mean, this is self-selected. But the point is that that's fine from the Kremlin's point of view. Again, you know, it wants to know about the people who have enough enthusiasm and passion that they are going to bother sending in some kind of message, because those are the ones who are going to be problematic. So what they want to do is to be able to get a sense of how many are they, where are they, Who are they, in general terms? And what are the issues that seem to motivate them? What are the issues that actually they think are important enough that it's worth taking what is, after all, a potential risk? I mean, if I'm using parallels, you know, we should note that the current oppression strategy that the regime uses is not, I mean, however sort of heavy-handed and ghastly it is, it is not certainly a totalitarian one. It does not seek to basically roll people up by the hundreds of thousands or even millions for the most minimal of offences. Instead, it is still very much, you know, once you're past the particular, you know, media outlets and high-profile opposition figures, you know, when it comes to ordinary people, it is still very much about picking some specific examples to make. You know, when you have some poor individual who goes to prison for throwing a water bottle at a fully body-armoured riot cop, poor fragile little snowflake that the Amon clearly are, that's ridiculous. But in some ways, that's the point. The more ridiculous the example, the more excessive and over the top, the more it creates this sense of, well, you never ever know. You do not know where the lines are, because there are no lines. It's a largely random process. Therefore, best not to go to the protest. Therefore, best not to retweet that mildly subversive message or stick that meme about Putin on your Facebook page or whatever else. It is, again, if I'm playing with parallels, the Dirty Harry school of oppression. The do you feel lucky, punk? And, you know, most people won't. So, you know, but nonetheless, it does mean that therefore these people might be bringing themselves to the attention of a capricious state that does like to make examples from time to time, and yet they still do it. So this is, I would suggest, the hidden value of direct line to the regime. You know, it's another way in which they get to monitor the mood and the concerns of their own people, and, you know, how far they are successful or indeed bother to then take advantage of that also tells us a lot about actually just how effective and smart the people who are the current political operators behind the Kremlin's machine. And that's still something of an open question, has to be said. And it gives us another reason why Putin sticks with it. I mean, let's be honest. When he first started it 1 year into his presidency, it was, you know, absolutely a breath of fresh air. You know, the chance for ordinary Russians to talk to their president, I mean, even frankly, within advanced democracies, there isn't that same level of potential contact. Over the years, though, this has become more and more of a sterile ritual. And also, over the years, I mean, not just generally, as Putin has kind of withdrawn from his own people, he clearly has got increasingly fed up and bored with it. I mean, his expression, less so, it has to be said, this time. Maybe after a year away, he was feeling more positive. I don't know. But certainly, if I think back to 2019 or indeed 2018, I mean, so often he just looked so fed up as he queried, you know, as he answered some other query about, you know, whether or not. I mean, my two favourite examples, well, one is in terms of absolute mind-numbing dreariness. As I recall, it was whether or not Chinese GPS trackers could be used on Russian cattle. And another example, just for the sheer sort of bizarre whimsy, was a woman ringing up to ask Putin whether or not her husband should allow her to get hold of a dog. I mean, of course, the answer is always yes to any dog. But nonetheless, you know, he was having to answer these and clearly not relishing this contact with his own people. But obviously, if he didn't do it, then people would begin to actually speculate. Oh, what does this mean? Is he ill? You know, is he worrying about his capacity to be able to hold on to this for 3.5 hours or whatever? So, although he got away with cancelling it last year, you know, basically he stuck with it for that reason. But as I say, it's also because it has a positive reason, because it is another one of the ways in which this kind of rather insecure authoritarianism tries to find out what matters to the people it's busy oppressing. And so, in conclusion, I mean, this underlines to me how actually politics still does exist, even under the shadow of the riot police and the foreign agent designations and such like. I wrote a piece in the Dutch outlet Raam op Rusland, which looks at this more broadly. Again, as usual, I'll leave a link in the programme notes. But specifically on this case. I mean, it provides an opportunity for the government to be able to do the things that politics is meant to make governments do. You know, if it's not because it worries about the vote as such, but about what would happen in elections if it doesn't try and address enough of the people's concerns, well, you know, arguably that is what politics is meant to do, one way or the other. It also, though, interestingly, I think creates opportunities for the opposition, especially now that it is essentially, and it will for the foreseeable future, be an opposition in exile. There will be many sort of dissidents and civil society activists and so forth still within Russia. But in terms of an institutionalized, structured opposition, no. It's clear that the Kremlin, even after the September Duma elections, is not going to allow that to happen. Now, they can still, for example, from exile, continue, for example, their smart voting strategy, which is precisely there to try and mobilise people to vote against United Russia, not because, let's say, voting for a Liberal Democrat or even Communist deputy necessarily is a better thing in general terms, but in terms of if it demonstrates the failure of the state's capacity to mobilise the vote in the way it wants. So, I mean, that actually does have an impact. But more broadly, I mean, what they can do is to try and tap in to this apparent still willingness of the Russian people to complain about specific issues. Now, actually getting people to send their complaints to the opposition would probably be a rather dangerous act, simply because, as we've seen in the past, when they tried to create databases whereby people can sign up, actually the state finds ways of cracking them, and it just makes people vulnerable, and obviously the more times you do that, the less likely they are to respond. But, you know, there are other softer, more indirect ways of monitoring what people are saying. You know, everything from, you know, local opinion polling to letters to newspapers to what people are saying on a whole variety of social media and such like. And yes, it would take resource to be able to actually collate all that. But I'm sure there are people who are willing to throw resources into it. I'm not quite sure whether the Navalny team really should be cozying up too much to Khodorkovsky, who clearly has the money, but I'm not sure if he fully appreciates the extent to which he is still genuinely toxic within Russia. You know, but even without Khodorkovsky, there are going to be other sources of resources. And so they could start doing things like generating heat maps, which show the intensity of feeling on various issues by various regions or whatever. They can identify key questions and such like. And what this would do would actually allow them, first of all, to identify what messages of their own would be most effective. But also, it's something that they can reflect back to Russia through their own channels. In other words, you know, giving Russia a sense of the real instead of the false real that is presented by the Kremlin. And this does two things. One is it shows that the opposition is active and cares about what ordinary people want. In other words, that it deals with micro-scale issues as well as the big macro scale of, you know, how will this country be run. And secondly, it will also force the government, or potentially could force the government, to be reactive to that. Now, why should they do that? The thing is, look, there are some, particularly, let's be honest, in think tanks in DC and certain other European capitals, who basically think that the only real resolution to this issue will be system change. In other words, regime change. And for them, ironically, they really sort of believe the kind of, there's a line from Plakhanov that certainly influenced people like Lenin, the worse the better. In other words, actually, that you don't want to find ways of ameliorating the plight of ordinary Russians. You want them to be angry. You want them to feel betrayed, because that's going to make them more likely to turn against the regime. Well, okay, I mean, I can see on an intellectual basis that rationale. But on the other hand, that is actually also treating Russians and their lives as just simply pawns of geopolitical struggles, and frankly is treating them just as badly as the Kremlin treats them. It's also worth noting that Russians themselves would probably not want to be in that position, especially because they don't have a particularly positive experience of revolutions and dramatic regime changes. I mean, actually, what do Russians mainly want? I suspect they don't care about democracy as democracy. Again, this is what links back to my earlier discussions. It's more that they just want this, you know, They want their services to work. They want their lives to be okay. They want their salaries to at least keep pace with inflation and for them to be afford a few basic luxuries and, above all, to feel that their kids are going to have a better life than them. Now, if they can get that through an authoritarian system, well, they're probably happy with it. After all, that is what happened through the 2000s. In the early Putinist years, I mean, that's exactly the social contract they had. And in a way, who are we to say that was a bad thing? I mean, it's a bad thing because it allowed an authoritarian regime that also, you know, carried out atrocities in Chechnya and oppressed and maybe killed individual critics, etc., etc. Look, I'm not saying that Putinism was a wonderful thing. I'm just saying that if actually we care about what ordinary Russians feel, maybe, just maybe, it should more be about making sure that they have proper public services and that their water is clean, rather than always focusing on what the Kremlin wants. And that's something, again, that if the opposition really wants to do, it could focus on that. And that could, ironically, also help their wider agenda by showing that they alone actually care about the Russian people and what they think. So this spins forth on the whole issue of the direct line thing. And I suppose it's more that because, you know, frankly, anyone who has to watch or read through the transcript of this phenomenally tedious event, well, surely you'll have to allow them to try and find some big picture reason why they did that. And on that note, let's stop. I'll have a quick break. And let's come back to the not quite so forever wars, the respective experiences of struggles in Afghanistan.
Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the show.
Once the United States had decided that it was going to be pulling out of Afghanistan, essentially that was obviously the end of the whole coalition deployment, given that the Americans essentially represented three quarters of the forces there. And so as this is happening, it seems to be a suitable opportunity to compare this particular 19-year war with the Soviet Union's own 10-year war in Afghanistan, which started right at the end of 1979 and rolled through until withdrawal in 1988. Now look, obviously these were in many ways very different kinds of wars, but sometimes not quite as much as people might think. I mean, at peak, it was interesting, in 2011, coalition forces in Afghanistan actually reached 130,000. Which is pretty much the Soviet peak at any one time, though generally it was much lower, and, you know, essentially the Soviets kept an average of about 100,000 personnel in country per year. So there's about a million Soviet veterans, both military and civilian, who came out. Obviously, though, the type of war that was fought was very, very different, and in some ways that's evident in the casualty figures. You know, the 19-year coalition war led to 3,580 dead so far, and I hope there's no more while this podcast is coming out. Whereas the Soviet fatality rate was something like 15,000, probably about 13,800, again, sort of directly the war. The rest were sort of as a result of lingering injuries and so forth. But still, 15,000 versus 3,580. And perhaps more to the point, vastly, horrifically different levels of civilian casualties. I mean, you know, the Soviet war led to, I think, basically 10 times as many. After all, the Soviets fought in a rather different way, a much more deliberately brutal one, with also large sort of set-piece offensives, and times in which their attacks on civilian targets, I don't think quite reached the level that some accused of so-called migratory genocide, but nonetheless were clearly geared to clearing areas of the local population. So, I mean, this is something that was really quite ghastly. Nonetheless, I mean, in their own very brutal way, one thing the Soviets did have that I would suspect that it's fair to say the coalition didn't was a much clearer sense of the political dimension of the war and, above all, their goals, what they were looking for. I think with the coalition, there was this sense that, there was distinctly mission drift, and there was also, because it was a coalition, different priorities as well as different rules of engagement from, different participants. Of course, what's going to happen now is the interesting thing. When the Soviets left, they had, by that point, installed a second leader in Kabul, Najibullah, the former head of the secret police, an able man, if not necessarily a pleasant man. And he survived, or his regime survived, until 1992. So the irony was actually it outlived the Soviet Union. And it fell, well, you know, arguably it was maybe inevitable, but he was doing quite a sort of cunning job of being able to build a coalition through various tribal leaderships. But never really, I think, recovered from, in 1990, there was an attempted coup by the defence minister, Shahnawaz Thani, which not only created some, I would think, some unfixable splits in the government, but also actually deprived Najibullah of, an exceedingly able field commander. But crucially, though, in 1992, Boris Yeltsin stopped all Russian support for the regime. And that was absolutely crucial. I mean, almost overnight, for example, the Afghan government air force, which clearly had been a sort of a crucial aspect of its operations, was basically grounded through lack of fuel and, spares. What about the current situation? Well, apparently US intelligence gives the regime in Kabul 6 months. So if anything, actually the situation sounds even worse. But what are the kind of the big takeaways, the comparisons that I think are worth drawing? I mean, first of all, look, and this is, again, nothing particularly enlightening, but, you know, the extent to which these were wars of imperial hubris. From Alexander the Great through to the British in the 19th century, imperial powers have time and time again mistaken the relative ease, of taking Afghanistan with the almost impossibility of pacifying Afghanistan. Actually winning this war. So that is a sort of striking case of way in which actually people seem continually to fail to learn lessons from history. And also the extent to which they went in because they misunderstood the situation or indeed willfully misstated it. I mean, if you look at the Soviet situation, I mean, they particularly went in, or perhaps sort of the crucial determinant, was a belief that turned out to be entirely wrong, that the previous leader of the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, notionally an ally after all, Amin, was in fact looking to swing over to the Americans, and so it would be a kind of a rerun of what had happened in Egypt, and all of a sudden, a country which, you know, frankly, the Soviets didn't really care about much, but nonetheless, it was on their borders, and the thought of it suddenly becoming an American satellite, which would mean that then, you know, everything from listening stations to missile bases or whatever could be placed there, that was regarded as unacceptable. As I said, though, I mean, it was all nonsense. Amin was not carrying out these talks. Let's be perfectly honest, he was an exceedingly unpleasant leader. And I think we need to shed no tears for his assassination and toppling. But nonetheless, one of the fundamental premises for the deployment, a deployment which after all was meant to be a very short-term one, the Soviets thought of this as a six-month operation. They would topple Amin, replace him with a rather more centrist figure, Babrak Karmal, because the sense was also that Amin was being far, far too aggressive in his attempts to reshape Afghan society, and therefore there was a huge jihadist, Islamic fundamentalist backlash coming. Well, you know, the idea was that a new leader would be a little bit more moderate. There would be a quick show of force to cow the Afghan people. And as I say, within 6 months, the forces would largely have been withdrawn. Of course, the Afghan people, for some strange reason, refused to be cowed. And the rest is bloody history. Well, likewise, I mean, if one looks at the American calculation, I mean, again, it was very much driven by, obviously, the totally understandable psychological need to do something after 9/11. But particularly that sense that really, when it came down to it, military intervention on this scale was the only way to get at Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and ensure that they could no longer find safe haven and that there couldn't be any more 9/11s. Now, look, there were no more 9/11s, but I don't think we can actually say it's necessarily because of the intervention. And in hindsight, clearly a much, much more effective way of dealing with Al-Qaeda. Remember, bin Laden was only found in 2011. And where was he found? He was found in Pakistan. But anyway, a more effective war would probably be the one that was fought by the assassin and the drone, the bounty hunter, and the alliances and the financial controls to stop Al-Qaeda being able to move money, and all these other kind of non-military means that don't actually involve you invading a country, which clearly is not particularly susceptible to being invaded. But still, that's the way it happened. In both cases, it's worth noting that the imperial powers were not defeated. They were exhausted. It's not actually as if coalition forces have been driven out of Afghanistan. And frankly, the Soviets could also have sustained their operation pretty much indefinitely. I mean, look, 15,000 dead, that sounds like a lot. But in 1 year, 40,000 casualties happened on Soviet roads from traffic accidents. And that's not a particular statement on Soviet roads or drivers. It's more just simply say that actually 15,000, it sounds a lot, but in the grand scheme of things from, you know, a large nation like the Soviet Union, it was supportable, it was bearable. The economic cost was likewise bearable. But in both cases, there was that point of just simply, where are we going? Do we think that we are going to be able to win without a massive escalation in force with all the costs that would entail? And the honest answer is no. I mean, Soviet generals said, look, if you want us to win the war, it will take 1 million troops. Could the Soviets have deployed 1 million troops? Well, yes, in technical terms, they could. In practical terms, though, I mean, it would have been ruinously expensive. It also would have had huge international implications. Well, likewise, I mean, time and time again, coalition commanders, particularly American-British commanders, you know, actually said that they could do a lot more with a lot more. But their political masters were not willing to make that kind of massive and, you know, potentially open-ended commitment. So it just came to a point where people think, well, this is not my war. I mean, Gorbachev's advantage was precisely he had not been part of the decision-making process that sent Soviet troops into Afghanistan. So he could actually withdraw and be the peacemaker without having to admit mistake. And likewise, you know, today, well, both the Trump and Biden presidencies, I mean, they were essentially, you know, untouched by blame, and therefore this could be someone else's war. They just decide, forget it. What is going to matter, though, is actually how this war is subsequently framed or interpreted. I mean, this is a bit of a hobby horse of mine, because I specifically did my PhD on the impact of the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And this was, I was doing this in the last three years, 98 to 91. So it was very kind of closing years of the Soviet Union. And people are interested. My book, Afghanistan, the Soviet Union's Last War, is out there somehow. But anyway, what was striking was not that this was a war that brought down the Soviet Union, as a lot of rather overheated claims suggest. Rather, though, that this is a war that became a useful metaphor, a prism, through which people could look at so many of the real problems that were actually besetting their country. From the fact that it was basically governed by out-of-touch old men who really didn't understand what was going on, all the way through to the degree to which veterans with all kinds of medical problems were not being given anything like the care to which they frankly were legally entitled, because of corruption and bottlenecks and everything else. So, you know, it was more that it became a metaphor for discussing wider problems. Now, obviously, look, the United States is in a very, very different situation from a collapsing Soviet Union. But nonetheless, I mean, I think particularly it's going to be interesting to see how the debate plays out in terms of future interventions. I mean, is this going to be a real force for a more isolationist approach or not? Because already we're seeing, in some ways, there's two, I mean, again, caricaturing it, but two broad schools of thought emerging. Between those who are saying, look, we shouldn't have gone in the first place, and those who are saying, look, if we were going to go in, we should have done it much harder and much more extensively. You know, if we had thrown more resources in at an early stage, with a clearer political message, this would have been easily winnable. Now, who knows if it would or wouldn't, but the point is, these are the kind of debates that are being played out. You know, this is not, I would suggest, the United States' Suez moment. relating to how the Suez Crisis and the military intervention that followed was in some ways crucial for forcing Britain reluctantly to come to terms with the fact that it was no longer one of the great global powers. So, you know, I don't think we're there. But I think, you know, as we do begin to see, in my opinion, the sort of decline of the notions of American hegemony, it's going to be interesting to see how those debates play out. Because, as I said, it will have much less to do with the realities of the war and much more with what people are able to make of it. In other words, how are they able to frame, present, mobilise and characterise the war for their wider political agendas? And on that note, thank you very much indeed for listening. And particularly to American listeners, I could wish you a very happy 4th of July, or maybe I could wish you a very happy Traitor's Day. No, I jest. Of course, we've got over that. But either way, thanks very much for listening.
Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. И только будь, пожалуйста, со мной.